Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frain is at the controls this morning. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, offer 10 different topics every week. And maybe you might want to check out our website there. You can get information about how you can listen to past programs. You can sign up for our podcasts, see what's going on in other phases of our programming. It's WILL.UIUC.EDU. In fact, we have a brand new version of the website, and it looks pretty spiffy, so you might want to check it out if you haven't looked at it recently. WILL.UIUC.EDU. This morning in this part of the show, we're doing that show that we call Talk to the Family Doctor. We do this every other month with our guest, Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician at Carle Clinic. He sees people of all ages in his practice, people with a variety of health concerns, and he's been good enough now for quite a while to stop by here on a regular basis to be an information resource. Now, I always try to remind people when we have doctors on the program that we can't diagnose over the telephone, so there is a little bit of a limit to what the doctor can do, but we're here to try to help you out, and if you have general questions, maybe even some fairly specific questions, I know that he will do his best to help you out. And then, of course, if you have real health concerns, you need to take them up with someone who can see you. This is a place you can start, though, by asking questions. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, you have questions, you can call us. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, David. I'm glad to be back.
I did actually, something just did occur to me. I know in the past we have talked a little bit about the vaccine for shingles, and I think I remember this right. Is there now actually a recommendation, or was there in fact before a recommendation about who should get the vaccine?
The vaccine specifically to help prevent shingles is relatively new within the last year, and is specifically targeted at individuals over the age of 60, since, at least statistically, shingles tends to increase with age. It can actually increase with other medical conditions that generally decrease one's immune competence. But since most of that loss of immunity seems to be age-related, currently the recommendation is for individuals over 60 to seriously consider that. Mm-hmm. The biggest problem we've had with it is some of the insurance companies, at least initially, have not chosen to cover it, so the cost of the immunization, which is probably at least a couple hundred dollars, is borne by the individual. Now, what often happens when a new immunization is released is after it becomes sort of standard to provide it, and there are a number of medical organizations that say this is sort of a required or at least strongly recommended thing to be doing, then once it becomes standard part of medical practice, then standard medical insurance usually covers it. But we frequently see this early on where something new isn't covered, at least initially.
Hmm. The shingles is a later manifestation of the virus that causes chickenpox.
Correct.
And back in the day when everybody got chickenpox, then that would meant that everybody at least was potential for shingles. Is there really any way to tell of, and I suppose things will change now as more and more people get the vaccine against chickenpox, but mm-hmm. for people who grew up in that age before there was the chickenpox vaccine, is there any particular way to tell whether one would be likely to get shingles or not?
There really, really isn't. In some instances, shingles seems to erupt at times when the person's general health has somehow been stressed, and perhaps there's a little bit more pressure on the immune system, a major medical illness, major trauma, surgery, some type of treatment, radiation, chemotherapy, something that changes the system and for some way allows that virus from the original chickenpox, which never left the body. It's been sort of lying dormant, typically in the nerve roots along the spine. Something allows it to reactivate, and the classic shingles is a chickenpox-like rash, usually in a band. It follows a specific nerve root, and that reactivation is associated with a great deal of pain and discomfort, and in the worst-case scenarios, even after the rash goes away, the pain remains. And that's one of the major things that they're trying to prevent is what's called postherpetic neuralgia, that persistent pain in the nerve even after the shingles rash has gone away, mm-hmm. because that can last months and sometimes years, and for some individuals be quite debilitating.
This is, and another question here, I'm sure this is something that we've talked about. Do we have some idea of whether for people who were vaccinated, got the chickenpox vaccine, and so then never would have gotten chickenpox, are those people going to be, is it possible we're also in some of those people going to see shingles? Or
yes.
That's just because you got the shot and you didn't get chickenpox, that does not mean you cannot get shingles later in life.
That is correct. Mm-hmm. There's something about later in life with a change in the immune system that allows reactivation. And if you can stimulate the immune system by re-immunizing, essentially, you're trying to ward off that reactivation of the initial exposure to the virus.
Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580 is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor from Carl Clinic in Urbana. He's with us every other month with a show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. This is a wide open opportunity to ask just about any healthcare question you can, can be for yourself, can be for someone in your family, could be for kids, because he does in fact see children and adults in his practice. And as we've said, you know, he'll do his best to give you an answer.
While we're talking about adult immunizations, most people are aware that a tetanus booster should be updated about every 10 years. Mm-hmm. And the other recommendation for adults that has come out in the last few years is for adults to also be re-immunized for pertussis, which is traditionally associated with the childhood disease whooping cough. That used to be an epidemic type of occurrence in terms of a childhood illness, but because kids are regularly immunized against it, we don't see it much anymore. But what has been found is that immunity also wanes, and there have been more outbreaks of pertussis in adults. So at least once during adulthood, when an adult gets their tetanus booster, they should also get a pertussis booster. And there is one manufacturer who makes a combination of tetanus and pertussis. So for those folks who didn't want to get an extra shot, they don't have to. It can all be rolled into one.
So you only have to get stuck once in that particular case.
Right.
Just since you mentioned tetanus, maybe it would be worth talking a little bit about that. This is the kind of thing that when we were kids, we all thought was the rusty nail disease.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
It had something to do with, you always want to be wearing your shoes outside because if you step on a rusty nail, you're in trouble.
Well, the tetanus spores are naturally occurring in the soil. And so anything that allowed an open wound to come in contact with things that had been in the soil is a potential portal of entry for tetanus. Now, because kids are basically getting all their tetanus boosters through school, you know, if they come in for their regular well-child exams and they're getting all their shots for school, they're covered for tetanus. And then adults basically just need to remember once a year to get a booster.
So,
but for folks who are, you know, farmers, carpenters, even, you know, active gardeners, people who are out, you know, in the soil, that's where the agent is. And so if you are going to come in contact with that, it's probably just a reasonable thing to make sure you get your booster.
So, and it would be the same kind of issue as anything that would result in a significant break in the skin wouldn't necessarily have to be in your feet. It could be in your hands or any place else. If you were digging around in the dirt and
sure.
you got a cut, that could be
that's
an
correct.
Issue. So it's probably a good, for that and maybe other reasons, probably a good thing if you're going to be doing that to wear some hand protection
mm-hmm.
and see if you can make sure that doesn't happen. And that the other thing, of course, is you need to want to make sure that your tetanus status is up to date.
Correct.
Yeah. What do people still get lockjaw?
No.
So pretty much
because
we now have immunizations
right.
for that. So that pretty much has
been taken. And that whole issue of immunizations being so successful has led to a society here in the United States where people aren't familiar anymore with the illnesses that people don't get anymore. And in fact, from a medical standpoint, most medical students, residents, physicians who've been in practice, you know, even a couple of decades, you know, haven't seen a case of measles. You know, it's like if measles walked in, you'd have to go to the book and look it up because nobody remembers anymore what it used to look like, simply because the vaccinations have been so successful in reducing the frequency of those illnesses. And, you know, only probably some of our older listeners would, you know, remember the, you know, polio epidemics of the 40s and 50s. The people growing up now have, you know, really no appreciation for how devastating a disease that was that is now completely controlled due to vaccination.
Right. We have a caller here. It's someone in Champaign County here where we are. And so let's talk with them. Line one. Hello.
Yeah, back to this shingles story. I heard some feature that I interpreted as if one of the reasons that we have so much of it, and I guess I don't know exactly how bad it is, but since it's such a horrible, painful ailment that eliminating some of it. Well, anyway, the vaccination has eliminated some of the exposures, and I got the impression that they implied that if you were exposed to an active case, that contrary to the idea that it would give you shingles, that it would actually be sort of like a vaccination. So, in other words, should we hang around somebody who's got the disease to raise the resistance?
You know, a number of years ago, I think young mothers actually had like chicken pox parties.
That's to expose the kids.
Exactly.
This is the idea of having adults who are worried about the shingles virus showing up in this other altered way.
Mm-hmm.
At a later date, should we attend shingles, or not shingles parties, attend chicken pox parties?
Well, you're not going to be able to find anybody who's getting chicken pox anymore because all the kids are getting vaccinated.
Right.
So there really aren't any, or at least not many, cases of actual chicken pox. In terms of somebody who has shingles, they themselves are not contagious.
Right.
If say you had an outbreak of the rash on your trunk, you know, if you're wearing your shirt and you're sitting next to somebody, you're not going to, you know, catch it from that individual. You'd literally have to probably break open some of the skin rash sores and try and rub it into, you know, an open area on somebody else's body if you even wanted to attempt to try and transmit that to somebody. So one of the things that we frequently run into is, you know, whether people with shingles, you know, need to, like, stay home from work and, you know, not expose their coworkers. And most of the time we say, well, you know, if you just keep your shirt on, literally, you'll be fine. So the rash itself, when it is on someone else's skin, is in no way going to leap onto somebody else. So there really isn't any way to otherwise boost your immunity other than being revaccinated, which is essentially what the shot is for.
Right. Well, now that raises the question of why is the this seems like there's an economy of scale in vaccinating the children. So is the adult vaccine to prevent shingles that much different than the chickenpox vaccine, and why is it so much more costly?
Or no, actually, it's not.
It's not any different.
No.
So I think this seems to me that you know, it's that means that all the kids' vaccines are theoretically also worth $180. So, and I just think that there's some kind of the usual price gouging, and it's a new item, it seems.
And what typically happens with any new, it's certainly medical, either medication or vaccination or equipment, when it is out there by itself, then there really isn't any competition, and the price can be whatever the manufacturer sets it at.
There's an argument that they need to defray the cost of the development, but if it's the same as the kids' vaccine, then there's no cost for development.
Actually, the cost is in running, even though it's the same kind of vaccination, they have to go through the whole FDA process all over again for a different target patient population. The vaccines were developed for children. This is specifically licensed for use in individuals over the age of 60.
I understand that theory, but it seems to me there's so much off-use use of drugs done informally that this is just not that big of a change, and it's been tested for so long, and it's outrageous if that much pain is caused by the fact that there's so much avarice in big pharma. I gotten to the same point where I always am again with big pharma. Thank you.
Right. Okay. Would you think it'd be reasonable to expect as more and more adults are getting this vaccine that the cost should be less per dose?
The economies of how the pharmaceutical companies figure out how much they're going to charge for something is sort of beyond my understanding. But any product that can be, sold in larger quantities, you should be able to recover some of your costs of manufacturing. There should, in fact, be some economies of scale. Mm-hmm. So ideally, if more and more people are doing it, the cost should come down.
So what you said in response to the caller about shingles was that you can't, if you're an adult, you can't catch shingles from another person who has it.
Correct.
I thought that one time, though, I might have heard that if you had never had chicken pox, mm-hmm. and you were exposed to someone who had shingles,
your exposure shingles. Would have to be a direct physical
contact. So that would be skin-to-skin contact.
Right.
Okay. So that would be, it sounds like that also would be pretty unlikely.
Correct. Now, the only other concern with any type of viral illness would be, again, contact with individuals who themselves are extremely immunocompromised. If you have an end-stage HIV patient, if you have somebody suffering from the effects of chemotherapy, those folks probably don't want to take any chances whatsoever. But for your average, walking around town kind of person, no, it's not something they need to worry about.
Okay. Our guest this morning is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician at Carl Clinic in Urbana, and every other month he's here for the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. And if you have questions, you can give us a call. I know he'll do his best to give you an answer. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Just for a second to go back to the vaccine issue, this is something I know that concerns physicians, it concerns people in public health field, that we are now at a point here because the vaccines have been so successful that we don't see a lot of these childhood diseases that we had seen previously so much. You don't see measles, you don't see polio.
Right.
Pretty much now it's going to get to the point where you're not going to see chickenpox. Mumps is pretty rare, although there have been recent outbreaks of mumps. So the worry is, I think some people worry, that parents maybe won't understand that it's important to have their kids immunized because maybe they grew up, maybe even now we have people growing up who in their childhood, that these things, they got their shots, mm-hmm. and so they didn't get those things. And that they're just, it's not kind of like on their radar screen, unless maybe their pediatrician or their mom or somebody is saying, hey, look, this is really important.
And that, I think there are concerns that there are going to be potential problems related to the vaccination. But in terms of their occurrence, it's really, really quite rare for somebody to have a significant problem related to the vaccination, and certainly nowhere near the frequency when people were generally unimmunized and were suffering from the actual diseases themselves. Those numbers far outweighed any concerns about side effects from the vaccinations themselves.
And maybe one more thing, and again, this is something we've talked about too, that people have this concern about the preservative. There was a preservative at one time.
Thimerosal. Thimerosal is a mercury-derived preservative that was used in vaccines, which has been absent from them for the last
7 years?
Six, seven, yeah.
Yeah,
somewhere
it's,
in that ballpark.
It's been quite a few years.
Yeah, it's so been quite a few years.
You know, if you're worried about that, you don't need to worry about that.
Right.
That's not in there anymore, and it hasn't been in there for
And there was never any medical data that suggested that it was actually a problem. But because of concerns, it was actually removed and has been absent now for 6 or 7 years.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk with someone in Charleston, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking about the topic you're talking about today, and I kind of would appreciate an answer that fit my condition. I'm over 70 years old, healthy. I've never had chicken pox, to the best of my knowledge. I should have been exposed 40 years ago when each of my three children in turn got it. And I should have been exposed 8 years ago when each of my three grandchildren got it. And I'm, of course, taking care of all of these people. So I've never had chicken pox. Should I be concerned about getting chicken pox or getting shingles and about getting the vaccination?
You can ask your physician to run a blood test to see if you, in fact, have been adequately exposed to chickenpox to have generated an immune response. There's a way to measure that.
Okay.
And if, in fact, you have been exposed enough to have generated an immune response, then essentially you had enough chickenpox, even if you didn't see any significant rash, to be immune up until this point. The current immunization for shingles is indicated for individuals over 60 simply because statistically that's where the most common number of cases will occur is in folks as they get older. So if, in fact, your blood test is positive for having had chickenpox or enough of an exposure to generate a response, then, in fact, you are a candidate to get the shingles vaccination.
And if it's not positive, it's negative?
Then you, in fact, could be primarily immunized for chickenpox.
Okay, and don't really need to be immunized again?
Correct.
Okay. Okay, this test, is there a name? Can you tell me the name of the test?
If you simply, well, it's done under different conditions in different laboratories, but if you basically ask your physician for a chickenpox immunity test, they'll order the correct thing.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, thank you for the call. It seems kind of hard to imagine that someone, you'd get to that age with all those opportunities of exposure to people who had chickenpox and actually never gotten it. And I guess it is possible to have it and have it be such a mild case that you might actually not
There's a difference between being exposed and becoming ill. There are a lot of people who get exposed to things who don't necessarily become ill. We don't recognize them because they don't have any symptoms. But if they were exposed and their body then generated the appropriate immune response, then they've acquired then subsequent immunity, even though they weren't ill.
Yeah. So it is possible that you could have been exposed to chickenpox and your body, as you say, did its thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you would say, well, I don't ever remember getting sick and going through the whole thing,
right.
But that you, in fact, we're exposed and have that immunity. And of course, then also that would mean that you would have the possibility of developing shingles.
That's correct.
But that you wouldn't get chickenpox again.
Correct.
Okay. We're at our midpoint here. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Something that I just thought I would ask you about just recently on the program, we were doing a program, and actually the program was about it was about seafood and about the environmental impact of the seafood industry and so forth and so on. But in the context of the conversation, the question of omega-3 fatty acid supplements came up.
Mm-hmm.
And this has to do with the fact that we are told that these kinds of oils that are in particular kinds of fish have some benefit, and the suggestion is that we ought to be trying to get more of these kinds of fish in our diet. And I guess there are some people who say, well, I'm not really sure that I can eat those fish, but I can go down to, you know, wherever they sell vitamins and supplements, and you can buy it in a capsule and you can take it that way. So I guess I was just wondering generally what you thought about that. But as a larger kind of discussion, whether you think there are particular supplements where there is where it can be demonstrated to your satisfaction that there's an actual benefit.
This is in terms of the sort of herbs and what are referred to as, I guess, nutraceuticals industry. That's sort of a multi-billion-dollar question because those things that are sold over the counter in health food stores aren't required to get FDA approval. They can pretty much claim whatever they want, and it's let the buyer beware. And the difficulty is, in terms of doing a study, is how do you hold everything else the same and then measure the effect of one trace item in somebody's, you know, intake? And in fact, most of the time, people aren't taking one trace item. They're taking, you know, a half a dozen or more things simultaneously. So then you have the question of, well, was it this or that or the combination that either helped or hindered or didn't do anything? So there's really a dearth of legitimate scientific information on the efficacy of a lot of supplements, which brings us back to the whole issue of, well, is the supplement as good as the natural source? People say, yeah, eat the salmon. Mm-hmm. And most people say, but I can't eat salmon 7 days a week. And some people will tell you, well, I don't want to eat those ocean-going fish because they're the ones who are concentrating mercury. So you get into that whole issue again. And so people say, well, I'll take the fish oil supplement instead of eating the fish. And the real question is, does that work as well? Don't know yet. There was some interesting work with a substance called lycopene, which is found in tomatoes. Mm-hmm. Was thought that, at least in epidemiologic surveys, that folks who ate a lot of that, men in particular, had fewer prostate problems. So, you know, 2 minutes later, some vitamin company comes out and says, oh, we put a lot of lycopene in here. Well, is it that or the tomato or something else about your lifestyle? Or, again, not known yet. But some research in that particular instance suggests it's the tomato and not the vitamin with the lycopene. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole lot of stuff that people do thinking that it's helpful, or at least hopefully not harmful, and we don't have any idea whether it makes any difference. And the folks who do that, I always have to caution them that, you know, if you want to do something for your health and you want to spend time and energy and money working on that, I'm going to tell you to stop smoking. I'm going to tell you to buckle your seatbelt. I'm going to tell you to get your immunizations, you know, and then find a reasonable diet and an exercise plan. And then make sure you get your checkups for anything that in your family, you know, occurs more than just due to random chance. So there are times when people spend a lot of time and energy and money on things that aren't of proven benefit, yet totally ignore things that are well proven to be very, very healthful and helpful in having people lead long and productive lives.
Well, having said all that, let me then, because as you say, and I'm sure that nutritionists would say what we would prefer is for you to get your vitamins and minerals through your food.
Correct.
You know, have a good, well-balanced diet, have lots of fruits and vegetables, you know, watch the saturated fat, and, you know, the kind of stuff that we all know.
No, but not necessarily
do. Doing it, but we know it. Then... if you would say, well, I want to at least make sure that I want to get my basics, then what do you think of the value of just taking sort of a garden variety vitamin mineral supplement.
A general multiple vitamin once a day for most people is probably going to be just fine. Making sure that you've sort of covered the basis for my trace vitamins that maybe I didn't eat well today, but I will tomorrow. You know, I don't think anybody has any problem with that. And in fact, given sort of the nutritional habits, it's probably a good thing to do. What would be better, as you mentioned, is to improve our nutritional habits.
Yeah. The other day, Dr. Truppen was here, Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She's an OBGYN, and when she's on the program, and it seems like over the last few years, we've talked an awful lot about osteoporosis and about particularly the fact that women, in particular, not just women, though, it is an issue for men, but that women certainly should make sure that they're getting plenty of calcium and vitamin D.
Because your body needs the vitamin D to utilize its calcium.
And then you also have to have some weight-bearing exercise.
To stimulate your body's response to want to strengthen those bones.
Yeah. So that's one of those things, though you wonder, is it, you know, even if people are getting a good amount of dairy, and there is calcium in other kinds of foods, leafy greens have some calcium, whether it's really possible to get enough calcium and D through your diet, or you almost have to do some kind of supplementation.
You don't, because 3 dairy servings per day, whether that's milk or cheese or, as you say, your green leafy vegetables that have calcium in it, would in fact be adequate. But for individuals who simply don't have those 3 servings a day, then they're using the supplements instead. And that's probably fine. There probably aren't too many people who are terribly vitamin D deficient. You need about 15 minutes outside a week to generate enough vitamin D through skin production. And quite a few foods themselves are vitamin D fortified. So there's plenty of opportunity there to get that as well.
Okay. A little bit past our midpoint here. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor from Carl Clinic in Urbana. We do this program every other month, generally on a Monday, and it's your opportunity to call in and ask general kinds of health care questions. 333-9455 here in Champaign, Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller here in Effingham County, and it's line number 4.
Yeah, I have a question
on
that omega, that salmon oil. Do you have to worry about any mercury in that?
Not in the product itself, no.
Okay, then you'd be safe if you take that.
Yes.
Okay, well, that seems to be a lot of doctors are advocating that, aren't they?
I think it personally that it falls into a category of it's not an unreasonable thing to try, and the laboratory studies related to your cholesterol later will tell you whether it makes any difference or not. If it is part of a plan where you are paying attention to your other dietary intake, getting some regular exercise with or without prescription medication, the fish oil supplement, I think, falls into a category of it's a reasonable thing to try, and then measure and see if it really makes a difference. If it makes a significant difference, then continue with it. If it really doesn't make any difference, then you need to be doing something else.
Okay, I have one other question. On that, this here whole milk, it says it's fortified with vitamin D.
Correct.
Now, how much would that milk would you have to drink to really do any good?
Well, you would need 3 servings a day.
3 servings a day?
Correct.
Well, okay, then. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And again, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We're here in the season where maybe some people are going to start, maybe already have experienced some allergy symptoms.
Oh, yes. It's been good so far this year.
Has it been particularly?
Yeah.
And I don't know, you know, maybe a long, cool spring is either good for that or not good for that. I don't know. Is there anything particularly new in that field? Either, you know, in what people can do for themselves, because there's certainly plenty of stuff that you can buy over the counter, whether how well that works, you know, I don't know.
Well, the classic A's, of which there are three for allergies, the first one is avoidance. Unfortunately, in East Central Illinois, where stuff is literally floating through the air, it's pretty tough to do that sometimes. The second mainstay has been antihistamines, which block one of the chemicals associated with the allergic response. And sort of when all else fails, allergy shots. So those are the classic three A's for treating allergies. So if you know what you're allergic to, avoid it. You know, the people who have simple, straightforward, gee, every time I'm around the cat, you know, I start sneezing, my eyes water, and you know, my nose runs. Then we say, okay, get rid of the cat. That's sometimes emotionally traumatic for some folks. If you can't avoid it, then trying to block the response. And the two most commonly used things are oral antihistamines. But in fact, nasal steroid sprays have been shown to be more effective. But you can, in fact, do both if you need to. Some people just don't like the thought of spraying something in their nose, so they find the pill easier. But the medical studies that we have actually show that the inhaled nasal steroids actually work better. So some combination of an oral antihistamine and a nasal steroid is usually a very good combination for blocking the allergic response. There's another class of medication called leukotriene inhibitors, marketed under a brand name called Singulair, which can be used for both allergies and asthma. So in troublesome cases, we'll do those sort of three things. If somebody says, you know, I'm doing all the right things and my life is still miserable, then the next step is formal allergy testing, which is primarily done to produce the extract that you're going to get your allergy shots with. And there you're trying to build up blocking antibodies, and you're talking about, you know, a couple of years of allergy shots to try and get the benefit. So it's usually reserved for folks who, you know, are pretty symptomatic and haven't done well with the other more commonly used medications.
Mm. So that's it gets at this question that I'm sure that some people ask from time to time. Well, does it would it be a good thing for me to know, or for you as my doctor to know, what specifically it is that I'm allergic to?
It usually isn't going to change the management. Mm-hmm. You know, in most instances where people say, every time I go, you know, to grandma's house and she has a cat, I have my symptoms, it's pretty easy to identify, and if you can avoid it, then that's all you need to do. So there isn't any formal allergy testing that needs to be done there. The most common things that people are allergic to, when people say, you know, hay fever, ragweed, the trees are in bloom, the grass comes up, there's a number of things that, okay, fine, we can test you for it. What are you going to do about it? And the answer is, well, we're going to try the antihistamines, the nasal steroids, and the zinc. Yeah. So unless you're at a point where you're going to be doing allergy shots, there usually isn't a whole lot of extra benefit derived from the testing by itself.
The caller's here. We'll talk next with someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I actually have a question. Last year, I went to my physician just because I was feeling very sluggish, and I had actually gained some weight that really wasn't explainable. My physician did some tests and found out that my thyroid wasn't performing properly. I was diagnosed with hypothyroidism. I'm sure you know what that means. And basically, the doctor wanted to put me on medication. I currently don't take any medication, and I just didn't feel comfortable with taking the medication. And so she and I determined, okay, we'll just keep testing it to see if the thyroid levels go back down to normal. Eventually, they did, probably 4 or 5 months. I just started working out because I had stopped working out. I started eating better because I hadn't been eating properly. And so it went back down to, I believe, a count of 4 or 3. I don't know the proper term to use. But now I'm still feeling a little sluggish. And I'm fearful that the thyroid condition has, you know, resurfaced. Mm-hmm. I know that it can't be cured, but even management, my physician didn't tell me how to really manage it either. and she couldn't explain why it happens. She just says that many women have it. It's actually something that's underdiagnosed. And I just really didn't feel like answers were given. I just really had to do something on my own, versus because I didn't want to take the medication.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of information can you give me?
Well, you are quite correct. It's a fairly common condition. It does appear to be much more common in women than men. Why it occurs is not always known. It does seem to sometimes be hormonally triggered after childbirth. It is a not uncommon time for women to have thyroid problems. The thought is that sometimes viral infections will damage the ability of the thyroid gland to produce thyroid hormone. There are other individuals who have what are referred to as autoimmune diseases, where the immune system kind of damages the thyroid and decreases the amount of thyroid hormone being produced. You mentioned that you monitored your laboratory studies over a period of time.
Right.
Your body will, in fact, try, if it can, to sort of get things back to normal. So there are times when somebody's thyroid is, for a period of time, underactive. And if it comes back into the normal range on its own and stays there, then you know there really isn't any particular treatment required. On the other hand, if it goes into the underactive range and stays there, then you are in fact going to have symptoms, and you describe some of them, that just sort of sluggish, not as much energy, I'm fatigued. It makes it much harder to regulate your weight because your metabolism slows down, and so weight gain is fairly common. People will complain of constipation. They'll think that they're sort of colder in general than the folks around them. Those are fairly common symptoms. The hair and skin can become thicker and coarser, again, as this progresses. If you get to a point where your thyroid function is, in fact, underactive and staying there, one thing that I would ask you to think about is not so much taking medication.
Right.
You're simply putting back what's supposed to be there. So this is one of those times when I really encourage people not to think of it as taking a drug. You are supposed to have a certain amount of thyroid hormone in your system in order to function normally. And if for whatever reason your thyroid isn't providing that, you have the opportunity to simply take it in pill form and replace it. So this is really a situation that is different than a lot of other conditions for which medications truly are prescribed. This is really simply putting back what's supposed to be there.
Okay. I understand.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. Let's go on and talk with someone here on our line number 2, and this is someone in Charleston. Hello.
Yes. My wife had a hyperactive thyroid. Therefore, she finally had it removed, and when they performed the operation, they also took out the parathyroids. Therefore, she has to take calcium supplement pills, like 25 or 30 of them a day, and wondered what could be done to help her increase the amount of calcium intake other than the pills.
Other than dietary sources of calcium, I'm not aware of anything else she could do besides a calcium supplement. If it was technically necessary to remove the parathyroid glands at the time of her thyroid surgery, as you've already learned, the parathyroids help regulate your calcium metabolism. And without them, you really just have to do something external to try and get your calcium back into the correct range.
The parathyroid was not supposed to come out, but that was something that surgically happened.
Yeah.
I don't know what the reasoning was there, but surgically it happened, and he apologized for the actual removal of them.
Right. Once they're out, no, I'm not aware of anything else, again, other than an adequate intake of calcium, and that's either going to be in the form of dairy products or foods that are higher in calcium or a calcium supplement.
I know she takes the next test because I'm out of medicine anyway. But she's retired and has high blood pressure and a calcium problem and sleep apnea and everything put together just makes it take an awful lot of medicine.
Yeah, it's very challenging to keep up with that.
All right, thank you much, sir.
All right, thank you. We have a couple of minutes left. If someone wants to give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic, and he's on the program every other month. We do this show that's just a kind of a wide-open talk-to-the-doctor program. Whatever kind of healthcare concerns you might have, you can call in and talk with him, and he'll see if he can help you out. Again, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. It suddenly it has now gotten warm. And
thank goodness. This seemed to be the world's longest winter. I don't know about you, but I'm ready for some warm weather.
Well, I don't know. 70 is nice.
80 is too high?
88. That's starting to get a little bit warm. I'm just thinking that I wonder if it's, if it's too early just to remind people if now suddenly it's significantly warmer, humidity levels are going up. If you're going to be doing work outside, you're going to be very active. Do keep in mind that you want to be well hydrated, and because I'm just thinking some people may be caught almost a little bit off guard that it now suddenly has the temperatures have jumped so high.
Right.
And it seemed to me, to my system, it's a little bit of a shock.
We didn't have that gradual change of season.
Yeah.
So, but you're correct. If people are going to be physically very active outside in warmer, more humid weather, they have to be very careful that they themselves don't become literally overheated. And just like the radiator in your car needs a certain amount of fluid for it to function effectively, the human body needs an adequate amount of fluid as well to maintain normal core temperatures. So the key here is to make sure that you're getting adequate fluid replacement if you're outside doing something that's causing you to lose a lot of sweat. Essentially is the most common place for people to lose those extra fluids. But people are breathing heavier. There's actually a fair amount of fluid that goes out through the respiratory tract as well. So sometimes just being out in warmer weather, even if you don't think you're all that physically active, can lead to some mild dehydration.
Yeah, the standard advice is what you're telling people is they should make sure that they have access to and drink plenty of water.
Correct.
That's the basic things that we're trying to do.
Right.
And are there circumstances under which some of these kinds of particular products that were, I guess, formulated for athletes or people who are maybe thinking they're going to lose, working so hard that they're going to lose a lot of fluid, and not just that, but the other sort of chemicals that are in there that's important to keep you functioning. And under what circumstances do those things actually make sense?
Well, in most instances, if you are still eating well, you just need to replace the fluids. If you are, in fact, participating in some very vigorous activity, especially for a prolonged period of time, when you're, if you're taking the 100-mile bike ride and not eating, then the, quote, Gatorade-type product that has a little sugar, a little sodium, a little potassium in it is a perfectly reasonable replacement fluid on a short-term basis, and I think makes perfectly reasonable sense. But if all you did was mow the yard, you probably just need to go in and get a glass of water.
Get a glass of water. Gatorade is not really necessary.
Probably not
mowing the yard.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Anything else that you might like to leave with folks?
Well, I'm hoping that the few phone calls that we are enjoying here today are as reflective of the good state of general health of our listening public, and that they'll stay that way.
Either that or they're so ill they can't even
get to the phone.
No, let's hope that obviously the people are doing well. And I guess we will, later on in the week, we'll have an opportunity to talk about skin issues. We have a Lester Farner, one of our dermatologists, is going to come in. But I suppose we could also nag people about this and say that, if you're going to be spending a lot of time outside, you're going to be exposed to the sun,
I'm sure he will tell everybody to, you know, wear their hat, cover up between 2 and 4, and use lots of sunscreen.
Do you think that that's a message that is getting through to people?
Everybody except teenagers before prom.
Oh, I see.
Who always want to have a tan for their picture.
I know. Well, I know, on behalf of the American Academy of Dermatology, as far as the tanning thing goes, they would just like us to say no.
Right.
Don't do that because apparently a small number of times can be really damaging, and that kind of thing. You might not see it right away, but later on it's going to.
It's definitely associated with aging of the skin. So for, you know, at least the folks who say they want to look good, well, if you want to look good long term, then try and avoid it.
Yeah. All right. Our guest, Dr. Jeff Swearingen, he is a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana. He's here always on a Monday. I think it's always on a Monday. Every other month to do these shows so we can give folks a chance to ask health questions. Thanks very much.
Thank you, David.
Appreciate it.